We're back with the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell had just posed a very interesting question to Dr. Cornel West about process, about justice, about how things move forward.
Absolutely. I mean, the great Reinhold Niebuhr said democracy is a proximate solution to insoluble problems.
Yes!
And what I think he meant by that was that democracy is always unfinished, always incomplete, always open-ended. Authoritarian regimes want closure. But if you accent the open-endedness, then you must accent process. And by process, it means, you know, voices being heard at the highest levels of decision-making processes in those institutions that guide and regulate people's lives. But it's always shot through with contestation, conflict. That's why dialogue is the lifeblood of a democracy, because serious dialogue, not chit-chat, but serious dialogue is Gegenstein. It's wrestling and grappling. It's almost like Jacob with the angel, right? But see, that kind of talk about democracy is very threatening to elites, because elites want closure. They want control over the flow of information, the way in which the discussion goes. Democracy is unpredictable.
You're talking about liberation theology here. You're talking about jazz. You're talking about the human exchange. Aren't you talking about being alive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. See, democracy is fundamentally what one would call a plebodicy. What I mean by
that is
just like theodicy is wrestling with trying to reconcile a good God with misery in the world. How do you justify the ways of God to in light of the fact that the world is full of so much unjustified suffering? This is the Grand Inquisitor of Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, right? This is a profound question. Theologians wrestle with it all the time. But plebodicy is how do ordinary people respond to unjustified suffering? Well, they respond by organizing, trying to create a process in which their voices are heard so that they do not get a raw deal, you see. And there's no solution to theodicy, and there's no solution to plebodicy.
But there's a lot of work.
There's a lot of work with the stress on process that Brother Bill was talking about.
The first response is to find a God to assign responsibility to, which is the old way of doing it, which is how we got to theodicy. Mm-hmm. And what you're suggesting is a different, you know, having tried that, and for at least some people, finding that not to be a fully adequate solution, that instead of assigning responsibility out there someplace, that we have to take responsibility ourselves.
Absolutely. But we take responsibility ourselves along with the mystery, because it's not as if by taking it ourselves and acknowledging our own autonomy that we're going to solve the problem. See, the problem, I mean, if we simply just transfer the problem from theodicy to plebodicy and think, well, okay, God can't solve it, we will, that's another form of self-deception. Because there's no solution. It is how do we forge courageous engagement, vision, courage, democratic process, which is patience as well as painful, but necessary if we're going to hold off authoritarian options, you see. So that I don't think there is a solution.
Is that the mystery of which you speak?
And that's part of the mystery, because in the end, as human beings that move from womb to tomb, human beings who come in the world through a woman's womb are relatively helpless, looking for love, care, meaning, but being also creatures toward death, and hope that one finds some compassion in the interim. That creates anxiety, insecurity that is inescapable. And no political regime, no social system will ever be able to completely eliminate that anxiety, that insecurity, that wrestle with meaninglessness, and that wrestle with being inevitable death.
Richard Slotkin has studied American myths, and in a sense, this is another way of representing, I think, what you're talking about is the mythologies that inform us, mm-hmm. and then inform our environment. He also argues that the American myth is dead, that the last nail went in sometime around the time of the Vietnam War, and that we are now in a time where we need desperately to create, and not to say this is a conscious process,
right.
but somehow or
right.
other,
right.
create new myths. And he goes further to say that new myth has to address two fundamental parts of the American of American history, American thinking, American worldviews, and that is violence, who gets to use it, mm-hmm. and under what circumstances, and race. Mm-hmm. That those are at the center of what America, at least, has to deal with. And mm-hmm. and that sounds in many ways parallel to a lot of what you have talked about and written about, is that mythology, creating that mythology or developing as not as a single articulated idea, but as a collective something that will emerge from collective engagement.
Yes. No, I think that that's a major challenge. But I mean, unlike the William Blakes and William Butler Yeatses, who generate self-manufactured mythologies that only last relative to their own lives, myths, as you and Plotkin and others know, are rooted in long, long, long histories. And the frontier myth, which is the dominant myth in the shaping of American civilization, does not, I don't think, die as easily as he suggests. It has to be redeployed. Unfortunately, it's been captive to a manifest destiny doctrine of imperial expansion against indigenous peoples, moral regeneration through violence, going west when the crisis in the east is such, and as you go west, you feel refreshed and empowered and so forth. Those versions ought to die. But I think that the myth of the frontier has to be redeployed. I don't think there's going to be any more powerful myths in American civilization, that our self-understanding is so rooted in 1776 and in the West and so forth. Martin Luther King Jr. was quite a genius at this, because he understood that the myth of the frontier had to be deployed in regard to new forms of exploration having to do with wars on poverty, having to do with regenerating democracy. But these are still ways of exploration associated with myth. And myth, the frontier itself, of course, is the line that we draw between so-called civilization and so-called wilderness or barbarism. And if you define, you know, Jim Crow as barbarism, then you've got a moral deployment of the youth of the frontier to generate moral energy to wrestle with that barbarism.
So these are moral frontiers.
Absolutely. And you see, for me, you know, barbarism is heterosexism, it's imperialism, it's vast economic inequality, it's white supremacy, it's male supremacy, it's losing sight of the humanity of disabled people. Those are the moral equivalents of war that William James talked about in his famous essay of 1910. And James also deeply rooted in it, acknowledging the role of the frontier. You just had to recast it. Yeah. So I don't think that these national and myths die well. I think we need to cast it on a national scale. I think nationalism is a form of tribalism, and I think we have to acknowledge that the life of an Iraqi baby or a Palestinian baby has the same value as the life of an Israeli baby, a baby in Malaysia, a baby in Africa, or what have you. So we have to come up with ways of internationalizing and globalizing our struggles against forms of barbarism, as opposed to the older definitions of barbarism, you see, which were racist and sexist and so on. But there are progressive possibilities of using older myths, because you have to acknowledge that we are who we are. We're born in circumstances not of our own choosing. And to be in the new world, to be in America, means that you're not going to leapfrog over these myths, even as we try to escape and we actually end up reproducing them. In a certain sense, Kennedy understood this, the new frontier, in his presidential administration. And I think that progressives, radicals, have to understand the specificity of the United States. You learn lessons from Antonio Gramsci in that way.
You talk about yourself as a radical Democrat.
Absolutely.
With a small D.
Small D, yeah, indeed.
I think it's easy for people to lose track of why you would be. I mean, here you are talking about all of these people who have big ideas, most of them dead, and you're bringing them forth as if there's a real vitality in these ideas, as if it matters.
Oh, absolutely.
Where does the radical Democrat fit into this larger need for expanding the myth, for growing, for taking these big ideas?
Well, one is because there's a strong Socratic dimension to being a radical Democrat. An example of life is not worth living. An example of life is painful. You can't be a radical Democrat without putting a stress on experimentation, on exploration, but that includes self-exploration, self-examination, and very, very painful forms of self experimentation, and you experiment with yourself. There's an existential dimension now. I mean, I'm a kind of an existential Democrat.
Let's come back to what on earth an existential Democrat would be in just a moment. Bill Russell and I are so pleased that Dr. Cornel West is our guest. We'll all be back in just a minute. Please stay tuned.